Hello and welcome to The Media Show. I'm Brenda Power, and in the programme today, the last in our current series, RTE radio boss Claire Dignan on leaving RTE and her best and worst days in radio.
The death of Gerry Ryan was just one of the most shocking and awful things that happened in my 4 years in radio.
And why animation in Ireland is one media sector booming in recession. We hear from a young company keeping the kids happy.
It forces you on a daily basis to come to the office and think in that sort of unfettered way that children think.
But first, vive la France, vive la différence. It seems while the rest of the media world is worrying about paying for content, while revenue shifts online to players like Google and Amazon, the French government is seeking to protect its culture by taxing smartphones and other internet-enabled devices and plans to use that revenue to fund French content. And if the French make it work, the rest of Europe may well follow. Journalist Anne-Louise Delapuop joins us now. Anne-Louise, this report proposing the new tax has been headlined around the world as a tax on smartphones. Is that the focus?
And there's much more to the report than just the tax on smartphones. But this is seen as one of the ways to compensate for the shift that's happening at the moment. The power base is shifting to Google, to Amazon, to online services. So online content is coming down the pipes for free, basically. So in order to maintain the fund, the idea is to shift the tax at the moment, which is on hardware such as DVDs, CDs, USB keys, to shift that tax to all connected devices so that you might pay 1% of your purchase price towards that fund that will ultimately keep French cinema going, French music, French TV co-production. Because at the moment, apparently, the tax on hardware, recording devices, DVDs, CDs, USB keys, for example, that produces 200 million a year. If the tax is introduced immediately on all connected devices, apparently, according to the report, it's going to provide 86 million a year. I mean, one would imagine that that tax on smartphones, we might start at 1%, but it could conceivably increase in order to finance French cultural fund.
So, Anne-Louise, this report talks about the cultural exception as the basis for the new tax. So why do the French think they're so special, so exceptionnel?
Well, it has historic roots, of course, like many things that the French hold dear to their hearts. The French cultural exception was conceived as terminology during the Uruguay round of the negotiations for the General Agreement of Tariff and Trades. And so for France and for Europe, it meant that culture could be treated differently from other products, from clothes, from food, that culture is something that's important to a nation's identity, and that should be kept apart. I think one of the reasons is that it's institutional in France is because of those historic roots. And also, it's a matter of pride. It's a matter of a feeling of keeping the French language alive, keeping the French cinema, the film industry alive. And if there was no cultural fund to support that kind of endeavour, then I think the feeling is that France would become colonized by the US and overtaken, and France would lose its identity.
And that was journalist Anne-Louise Delapuop there, something perhaps for Pat Rabbit to think about. Isn't our culture exceptional too? Now, while we've been hearing a lot of doom and gloom about the media during this series, one creative media sector which is booming in Ireland is animation. Animation is worth 200 billion euros globally, and in Ireland it has really taken off over the last decade, generating around 100 million euros a year and employing some 2,000 people, with companies like Brown Bag making headlines across the world. Now, 12 years ago, two young animators, Andrew Kavanagh and Gary Timpson, started Cavalier, and they now list CBeebies, Sesame Workshop, RTE, ABC Australia and PBS in the States among their clients. Kate Neclary paid them a visit.
What I love about animation is constantly seeing new ideas being transmitted through animation in a way that I don't see so much through other art forms. I think it's still the best medium for a child's imagination to engage with. It forces you on a daily basis to come to the office and think in that sort of unfettered way that children think. So, I mean, how could you not like working in that medium? I am Andrew Kavanagh, CEO of Cavalier Productions.
Might be time for a little treat.
Yay! The time spiral!
The industry's grown so much in the last 5 to 10 years that, you know, everybody's busy. I'd say every studio in town has probably about 20, 30 people thereabouts. And that's a lot of animators, you know, and it's just grown so quickly.
I am Gary Timpson, the Managing Director of Cavalier Productions.
We're working on 2 TV series at the moment. We've got a show called Wildernuts, which is for RTE. It's a preschool show. We just started a new TV series called Bodgin Buddies, which we're working with the UK partners. It's going to be on PBS in the States, ABC Australia, CBeebies in the UK, RTE locally.
We need with the storytelling.
Cavalier would have probably 4 or 5 projects on the go at any one time. Like, development takes so long. Gareth and Bev was one of our flagship projects that we produced in 2008, 2009. It was in development for probably 2 years.
Time for a little treat.
I'm Shannon George, and I am a producer at Cavalier Productions. I was looking to move to Europe from Los Angeles, and a mutual friend who'd worked with Cavalier in the past introduced me to Gary and Andrew. There is definitely a difference between animation that's done in the U.S. and animation that's done in Ireland. Probably the biggest thing being in America, we get picked up by a network and you just kind of go. I come from Nickelodeon, so it's like, okay, the show got picked up, let's go make it. Here, there's a lot more involved in like the 481 tax credits and just the different avenues you have to get your project financed. So as a result, a lot more animation gets off the ground over here.
The tax credits are a big help. Somebody coming into Ireland can get up to 28% tax benefit for having the work produced in Ireland, which is massive help.
Build a better boat.
I love everything about it. I love everything about animation. I think we're very lucky to be doing what we're doing. You know, a bad day that we have, you know, we're still making cartoons. We're still being creative. We're still doing something that makes people happy and that people watch to have fun, you know. And what I love about animation is that it allows me to be creative. It allows me to have a job that's fun. It allows me to work with fantastically talented people.
Cavalier has traditionally between 25 and 40 staff. This summer we'll be up to 50, which is about as big as the company gets.
I knew you'd discover something.
I have a 4-year-old, and he's watching, you know, Gareth and Bev on RT Junior, or Lifeboat Luke, or Wildernuts when it comes out. That for me is kind of the magic of it, because, you know, like, we created that series. I remember when it was just a sketch. It's moving. They're talking. It's the beauty of it, really.
You're gonna love what happens.
And that was Caitney Clary reporting on happy times in the world of Irish animation. Now, Claire Dagnan is one of RTE's longest-serving executives, having joined the station after leaving college. She produced a number of groundbreaking programmes, including Women Today with Marion Finucane and the Women's Programme on Television, and went on to hold several senior positions in both radio and television. She was appointed Director of Programmes in RTE Television in 2003, before being named as Managing Director of RTE Radio in 2008. Last week, she shocked colleagues in the station by announcing that she will leave the job next month. Claire, you've described your departure as one of the hardest things I've ever done, so why go?
Well, yes, it was one of the hardest things, or is one of the hardest things I've ever done, because I have absolutely loved my career in RTE. But in terms of why I'm leaving, it just feels like it's the right time. I'm not hanging up my boots from a professional point of view. I'm very interested in developing what the jargon describes as an encore career, which is where you leave maybe the main thing you've done for the bulk of your career and you explore other areas and other opportunities. And this just feels like a good time for me to do that. Bottom line for me in all of this has to be that whatever I consider taking on, it has to be as interesting as I've found all those years in RTE.
Have you something specific in mind? Or
no,
you open
not
up?
At all. People ask me that. I'm not going to anything. I'm actually going to take some time off initially to do a bit of thinking about what I might do next.
Can I bring you back then, many, many years, as you said yourself? Pretty much straight from college you went into RTE. It must have been a very different place.
When I look back at how young I was when I went into RTE, I had barely turned 21. I look at what the kind of unformed person I was then and I think, gosh, it was a very brave person who hired me. I wouldn't have hired me at that time. And yes, it was a very different time, but I was fortunate, as were a number of colleagues of mine who also joined in that period, which was the sort of late 1970s. It so happened that a lot of people who had been with RTE for many years were coming up to retirement age, and management, and particularly Michael Littleton, who was the head of Features and Current Affairs, was looking at the changes that were taking place in Irish society. the changes that were taking place in media and also the changes that were taking place in radio. And he would have been the man who was responsible for bringing talk radio as we now know it, as modern radio consumers, to Irish listeners on RTE. And he recognised that with all the changes that were happening in Irish society at that time, and it was a time of great social turmoil across Europe as well and in the United States, that the people making programmes in RTE didn't necessarily reflect in their age or their interests or their sensibilities the kind of questioning of the established mores and values that was happening right across Western Europe. So he looked to recruit more women and he looked to recruit younger people. And that was very fortunate for a number of people, myself included, because we got an opportunity that I think maybe in a different time we wouldn't have had.
And were women a rarity in the media and particularly in broadcasting in those days?
There were not very many of us, I have to say. Marion Finucane was a young cub reporter around that time. Marion Richardson was somebody who not long after I moved to radio had been looking to enter the media, and she and I worked on a young people's programme, which again was long before the days of RTÉ Junior Radio. But certainly on the radio side, no, women tended to be broadcasting in up the music end or the soft reporting up the softer features end, continuity announcers.
Now, Claire, you would have been behind Women Today and the women's programme on television. Was there a sense that you were breaking boundaries at that time?
Yes, I think very much with Women Today in particular. Again, it was a time that there were so many social issues that were of great concern to women in Irish society. There was no divorce in Ireland at that time. There was no availability of contraception at that time. There was an infamous employment case where a woman who was a teacher in County Wexford, Eileen Flynn, who was pregnant and was cohabiting with her partner, was dismissed from the school because it was felt her lifestyle didn't reflect the values and the mores of the school. There was a spate and into the early 1980s of babies being found, the Kerry babies case. So there were all of these things were happening. And quite a few of them were not finding their way into the news agenda of news and current affairs programmes in RTE at that time. So Michael Littleton, who was the head of features and current affairs, put out a call that he was looking for proposals for a daily women's programme. And myself, and I'm sure a number of other people as well, threw our pitches in. And I was asked to set up the programme, which we ended up calling Women Today. And it is now looked upon as being groundbreaking. And I think even at the time it was because of the topics and the issues that we covered, which just hadn't been covered on radio before, from the minute to the very significant, you know, from quite small things about how women reared their daughters or inheritance on farms, which actually was a very big thing in the agricultural community at the time. Farmers who had daughters who really wanted to farm and sons who didn't want to farm would still opt to leave the land to the son while the daughter was forced to go off to agricultural college and then leave the industry altogether or find work in some other sector. And then the very, very big issues as well, of the legal issues and the inequality issues and equal pay and all of those. So they were covered on a daily basis on the programme. Very fortunate in the team that I had working with me. Marion Finucane was the presenter of the programme and Dernie Vrean was a reporter and Patrick Farley, Betty Purcell, a number of really excellent people in their fields. And we were just lucky we hit the ground on the day that RTÉ2FM was launched. We also launched in June 1979. But the programme was an almost immediate success, but it garnered a lot of criticism and a lot of media commentary. I never knew at the time, but there were at senior level in RTÉ and on the RTÉ authority at that time, there were people who were very unhappy with the programme and with the sort of issues that it covered. Indeed, I have to say my own father, Lord rest him, at my wedding, which was in 1980, made it part of his father of the bride speech to make it very clear that whatever that people might have heard in the radio programme that they thought they were my views, I hadn't learned them from him or hadn't learned them at home. So he felt that was important. But that would have been typical maybe of a lot of men of his age. I remember we did a programme on sexual problems that women had, the kind of problems they had, you know, women who just didn't enjoy sex or who were in a relationship or married to him. Most people in those days were married rather than cohabiting, so married to somebody who had lost interest in sex, or any number of things like that, where they could go, what help was available to them. Women contacting the programme saying they'd had six children, they didn't want any more, they had no access to contraception. What did they do? They loved their husband, but they didn't want to tell their husband to move into a separate room, etc. All those kinds of discussions on topics and issues. Now, it wasn't all about sex, but they would have been the sort of ones that attracted particular disapproval. I do recall a priest who was a lecturer in Maynooth describing in an article that he wrote in a Catholic publication, he was talking about that particular programme, and he referenced that Marion Finucane was the flea in the marital bed of Ireland. And that was his description of her.
But when you see the issues that are galvanising the country today since the Civita case, there's no specific women's programme on RT anymore. BBC kept its women's hour. Do you think that there is sufficient forum to air women's voices on radio?
It's a really good question. I think there are two aspects to it. I think a lot of the issues which are of interest and relevance to women and to men nowadays as well, because, I mean, even just the difference in how Irish citizens, male and female, feel about a lot of those issues and the level of engagement amongst men as well as amongst women. I think a lot of those issues are now part of the mainstream news and current affairs agenda. There was a long period when I thought they weren't, and I regretted the fact that RTE chose eventually to end the Women Today radio programme, although it evolved into Liveline, because Women Today was one of the first programmes that used the phone on a regular basis to put listeners on air. That was another actually significant thing about the programme. When you think back on it now, it's such a common model across radio, not just in Ireland, but around the world. So I think the issues that are on women's agendas in general do get covered in the media, not least because there are many, many more women now in production and editorial roles and broadcasting roles across media. That said, there's a separate issue around the representation of women on air. And I think if you listen and watch across radio and television programmes, this is an issue that still needs a lot more work, which is one of the reasons why I know you had Caroline Erskine on with you last week, that RTE, in association with Caroline's Association Women on Air, on Wednesday of this week, we had a training day for women experts, which we brought in 25 women who are very experienced and have a lot of knowledge in sectors and areas where women are underrepresented on air. And we hope we've skilled them up and given them confidence so that in future, if they get asked to participate or contribute to programmes, that they will feel that the radio and TV have been demystified a bit for them and they'll be confident in going in and contributing.
Now, Claire, when you moved to television, you got to produce lots of big shows, including The Late Late, but you also created the Independent Production Unit, the IPU. And today, much of RTE's programming is made by independent companies. So what was that like?
It was a very exciting time because there were very few independent producers in Ireland initially when we started having to do this, and there was a lot of resistance in RTE to these programmes coming in from independent producers. But the sector grew and flourished and attracted a lot of really talented people. Nowadays, for viewers, it's irrelevant to them whether a programme is made by RTE in-house or an independent producer, or TV3 in-house or a TV3 independent producer. And likewise for, you know, most of the production staff in RTE, many of them at this stage might have started out their careers working with independent companies. Many of the senior managers in editorial roles in RTE were initially successful independent producers. So there is a normality now about the fact that people can move across the sector. It also offers more job opportunities. But the main thing is that it has created jobs and employment in the independent sector. It has helped to grow the Irish film industry off the back of the television sector and the skills that people learned there. And it has undoubtedly enriched the RTE television schedules as well.
You would return to radio in 2008. Would that be your first love?
Yes. I just love the intimacy of radio. I love the fact that I wake to radio in the morning and I go to sleep to radio at night, and I'm in the car and I'm accompanied by radio. So as a consumer, I love it. To my mind, despite all the growth in new media and new technology and everything else, nothing has come along so far to replace that real sense of involvement that you get from a terrific radio programme. I vividly remember driving to Sandymount once to a meeting and listening to Liveline. It was about 2:40 and it was at the height of the period of people revealing what had happened to them in institutional care in this country. And a woman was talking to Joe Duffy about what she had experienced, and it was riveting. And I sat in my car for 10 minutes and tears were streaming down my face. Then he finished the interview and I leapt out of my car. And as I leapt out of my car, about five other people around me in parked cars also got out. And I said to one of them, "Were you listening to Joe Duffy?" And she just said, "I can't talk about it." And she turned and walked away. And I think that's incredibly powerful. And I don't know any other medium that can have that effect on a listener or a viewer or a reader or a user.
But it has been an eventful 4 years. What were the highs and lows?
Amongst the highs would have been recent international acknowledgement for what we do in RTE Radio, because of RTE Radio being designated Broadcaster of the Year 2 years in a row at the New York Festival, which is one of the top radio festivals in the world, and a huge compliment to what we do. And stitched into that, I suppose, is one of those combined highs and lows, which is because of the economic downturn and the reduction in license fee funding and all of the challenges that RT has faced since 2008. We're a much smaller organisation and we have much fewer people working in radio, for example, and we have much less money than we had back in 2008. I suppose in terms of lows, really the death of Gerry Ryan was just one of the most shocking and awful things that happened in my 4 years in radio. And I say this, you know, in full recognition that this was a man who was a husband and a partner and a father and a family man and a brother and much loved by all his family. And while I admired him, I wouldn't ever have called him a close friend, but I liked him hugely and knew him quite well. And that was just, you know, a really terrible time. During that same period, I suppose I ended up, because I would have some expertise, I suppose, in strategic communications, I ended up working quite closely with RTE's Director General around the whole handling of the Father Kevin Reynolds case and the real difficulties that RTE went through when we made the mistakes that we made in the production of that programme. And that would have been a very difficult time as well, when you saw the avalanche of criticism that there was and when you knew that much of it was correct and much of it was self-inflicted, and you love an organisation and you know that what happened was wrong but is not typical at all of how most people in the place work. That was very difficult as well, and very long and sustained. We've well moved on from that. We've learned a lot of lessons since that time, but that was a very difficult time as well, and one that I really regret that RTE had to go through.
Just to come back to the loss of Gerry Ryan, when Noel Curran was in with us last week, he referred to that and said, really, in hindsight, there was no plan B. Not that you could possibly have anticipated what happened, but that Gerry Ryan was such a huge powerhouse in 2FM that there was no alternative, there was no thought given to how he would ever be replaced. And 2FM has more or less lost its way, arguably, since then.
Well, 2FM had really lost its way before that. If you look at the listenership figures on 2FM, they had been declining consistently since 2004. I think the fact that the economy was so buoyant and commercial revenue was so strong maybe led to a complacency that there wasn't enough attention given to the fact that its listenership was declining. So as we got to 08, 09, that decline in listenership was accelerating. Then along came the economic downturn. And for advertisers who were being considerably more careful about where they chose to spend the money of their marketing budgets, they were moving away then from 2FM because they were looking at a decline in listenership. And myself and the outgoing head of 2FM, John McMahon, spent a considerable period working on how to refocus 2FM and reposition it. But we did do it built around the success of Gerry Ryan, because he was sitting from 9 to 12 with this enormous audience, which was reducing, but we very much believed that we could turn it around again. And it has been very challenging and very difficult to try and stabilise those audience losses. I think we have done that. We have a new head of 2FM, Dan Healy, who's joining us on the 4th of June. There's been a positive response from the advertising industry to that appointment, because Dan is a very skilled and very adroit person in terms of his understanding of growing audiences and growing listeners. And he's described 2FM as a sleeping giant, and I think he intends to wake it up.
And something like 57% of the audience share is with local radio, independent radio. What do you see as their strengths, and how do you import them into the national broadcaster?
Well, I think they're two different sectors. I mean, the great strength of local radio is its intimate relationship with its listeners, its physical presence on the ground, the fact that it can actually engage in content about topics and with people, many of whom will be known personally and experienced on a personal level by the listeners in the community in which they serve. I think it's a really important medium in the Irish media landscape, and I celebrate its success, and long may it continue. National media is different, and the national media services are different, and we can't compete on that level. So we're never going to be able to deal with the minutiae of the agendas and the stories that a local radio station can. But what we're talking about much more in national radio is the national conversation, is the sense of the nation coming together in the one place. I think the most important thing for all of us in Ireland is to value and work to preserve our own indigenous media, be it broadcasting or print, be it national or local. there's been such a change in the media landscape in this country in the last 10 years. And we're a small country. There's a finite amount of advertising revenue available for media in this country. And realistically, there's a finite amount of public money available to support public service media. And there is a huge amount of commercial income exiting out of this country every week to broadcasting services and media outlets that put nothing back, that don't produce in this country. And I think if we're not careful, we may rue the day that we stood back and continued to allow that to happen without also taking steps to protect our own Indigenous Irish media.
And finally, Claire, a lot of people would have had money on you to be the first female Director General. Was that not a tempting prospect?
Gosh, there's an interesting question. I look forward very much to the day when there will be a woman Director General. I'm pretty certain that in my lifetime that there will be. But we've a crackingly good Director General at the moment, Noel Curran, and I've absolutely no issues with his skills. He's the man to lead the organisation in the challenging times that we're in at the moment. Things need to fall at the right time, the right place. And for me, this is the right time to move on and to dip my toe in other waters.
And that was Claire Dagnan, who is leaving as head of RTÉ Radio in a couple of weeks. In our Media Watch column today, Mark O'Doherty of the Rise Foundation questions our alcohol-saturated media.
Bill Clinton, David Cameron, Barack and Michelle Obama, Prince Philip and Tom Cruise. What do they all have in common? Well, apart from the fact that they're each famous in their own right, each of them has visited Ireland in recent years and featured as headline news drinking a pint of Guinness. For the media, this is the money shot. But what message does it communicate? Doesn't it just feed into the long-held stereotype that Ireland and the Irish equals drink? Surely there is more to this great country and its people. On the other hand, think back to last July and the media's response to the drink and drug-fueled antisocial behaviour and violence at the Swedish House Mafia concert in the Phoenix Park. The news media all reported on it as a low in Ireland's relationship with alcohol. This just highlights the complexity between the alcohol and the media industries. Both industries are large employers, contribute to the economy, and are very powerful influencers. Looking beyond the news media, we are bombarded with alcohol messages on a daily basis. They are often so cleverly crafted that they almost go unnoticed, but they do encourage us to consume alcohol. International research has shown that alcohol marketing, including advertising, sponsorship, and other forms of promotion, increases the likelihood that adolescents will start to use alcohol and to drink more. The World Health Organization states, advertisements have a particular impact in promoting a more positive attitude to drinking among young people and recommends restricting the volume and content of alcohol marketing to reduce alcohol-related harm. It's time for a cultural change to free Ireland from its unhealthy relationship with alcohol. And the media has an important role to play in this.
And that was Mark O'Doherty of Rise. And you can find out more about their work in supporting families of those affected by addiction on therisefoundation.ie. I'm Brenda Power, and you have been listening to The Media Show. And thanks for listening through the last 8 weeks in our current series. And remember, lots of additional content and full interviews with some of our guests are available online via the rte.ie website and its mobile app. Talk to you next time.